Hello, I'm Earl Fontenelle. This is the Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast. Today, we're delighted to be speaking with Gerasimos Merionos, a faculty member of the National Hellenic Research Foundation and an adjunct lecturer at the Hellenic Open University. But most importantly, for our purposes, a man who knows a thing or two about the whole range of East Roman alchemy. Gerasimos, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Earl, for the invitation.
Of course. So, in our podcast, we've been very interested in alchemy, trying to track the highlights up till now, the end of the 7th century. And we've talked about two specific authors, the Pseudo-Democritus and the great Zosimus of Panopolis. But Zosimus of Panopolis lived back in the 4th century-ish. And now we're at Stephanos of Alexandria. We're at the end of late antiquity, moving into something recognizably medieval, maybe. And I thought it would be great to get the sort of status questionis on alchemy in this period, in this place, namely Constantinople and the empire surrounding. Who better to talk to than you, than your good self? So if we wanted to talk about the developments, the crucial to understand developments between Zosimus, the works of Zosimus, and, say, Stephanos of Alexandria, what do we need to talk about? What's happened in alchemy in that period that you really need to know about to understand the whole story going forward?
I think that we can approach this question a little bit traditionally by looking at the authors that we know that they wrote between Zosimus and Stephanos of Alexandria. So we have some commentators that write in Greek, and there are, of course, Synesius the alchemist, then the very important Neoplatonic, we could say, thinker, Olympiodoros the alchemist, who is to be discerned from Olympiodoros, the philosopher. But many, many, including Christina Viano, say that this is not so straightforward topic, you know.
Yeah. We mentioned that in the podcast, just briefly. Like,
yeah.
Olympiodoros, very interesting character. Also, he might have written an alchemical work, in which case he's even more interesting character. Anyway, moving on.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. And the important thing to know that is that between these authors and Stephanos of Alexandria, the venue is clearly a Greco-Egyptian venue. I mean, first and foremost, Alexandria, which, as you well know, it's something like something like between New York, London, and Paris of the era. But then things starting to move to the center of the East Roman Empire, or Byzantium, as we are calling it nowadays. And we have, a movement from the center of the late antique philosophy, which was Alexandria, of course, to Constantinople itself, the new capital after Constantine the First of the Byzantine Empire. This is a bit awkward to be discussed or, presented, because, as I said earlier, we're mostly based upon what certain manuscripts have transmitted us about these developments in alchemy through the works of certain authors like Olympiodoros and, of course, Stephanos. What I mean is that we certainly have links that we are currently not acquainted with, simply links that are lost.
Right. Yeah.
And we can see something of this, not looking at the alchemical literature, but tracing, evidence in the non-alchemical literature. Yes, because we have, evidence in non-alchemical literature. This evidence shows that alchemy was not as marginal as sometimes we tend to conceive it back then.
Okay. Now we're talking about the Greco-Egyptian context still, or are we now?
Yeah. Okay. We're talking about the Greco-Egyptian context, which, you know, it's very difficult to assess chronologically and in terms of, you know, the great demarcations between what is late antique and what is Byzantine, which is very difficult to place Zosimos and Olybiodorus between this or that period exactly.
Of course,
this is conventional.
Yeah.
But still, if we take, for instance, the Greek or the German Byzantinist school, Synesius, for instance, would have been considered to be a Byzantine commentator, not a late antique.
Mm.
And this is not, you know, just semantics. This is very important in order to assess the development between the thinking of one author to the other, because this development has many things to do with parallel developments in philosophy, you know, and in other traits of culture.
Hmm. Okay. I'm not sure I understand the significance, though. I mean, we call it Byzantine, we call it late antique, Roman, whatever. I mean, obviously they didn't call it, none of these, the people involved called it these things. Mm-hmm. Is it a case of a shifting cultural landscape on the ground at the time? So such, for example, the rise of Orthodoxy, the rise and consolidation of Orthodox Christianity.
Exactly.
Like this,
exactly.
That would affect what you think and what you do.
Yeah. But more than that, I think that it is important in terms of historiography.
Right, yeah. So we have to get what we say straight.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Exactly. Because it is not, you know, a problem of the authors themselves. Yeah. It is a problem how we understand these authors and their cultural environment.
Mm.
Because, you know, it must be said that Byzantine alchemy is understudied.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that it is understudied is that people tend to study things that remain under, you know, the name of antiquity.
Right.
It is it is more, you know, lustrous. It seems to be more important.
Mm.
And yes, you are right to stay on this. No, what I meant was from a historiographical standpoint. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, here on the Schwepp, first of all, we don't believe in the Renaissance as a historical phenomenon.
Okay,
so,
that's good.
So forget all that stuff about, you know, there was antiquity, then nothing happened for 1,000 years, and then we're back, baby!
Yes.
That, 'cause that never happened. We don't believe in that. We also think East Rome and indeed the Caliphate are incredibly important to the story of Western esotericism going forward. So that's our much more accurate, hopefully, historiographical context. That's also partly why I use the term East Rome rather than Byzantium, because no one called themselves Byzantines, except maybe some
yes, you're right.
The occasional poet who wanted to be very archaizing would say, like, here in Byzantio, like, but they didn't call it that. They called it Constantinople.
Yeah.
And they called themselves Rome. So they're Romans. You know, everyone calls them Romans except Western Europeans, and they don't really know much about what's going on in the world in our period.
Yeah, you're right. But I have to say that I tend to use the term Byzantium, Byzantines, and so on for reasons of intelligibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this context, you can use either East Rome, Byzantium, Constantinople, whatever. Our listeners will know what you're talking about. The Eastern continuation of the Roman Empire that will last until the final downfall in 1453, and we're away. So you've talked about the historiographical problem of bridging this gap between Greco-Egyptian world and the quote medieval Byzantine world. How does that show up in our sources? What happens to alchemy across this divide? Nothing? I mean,
no. Of course, many things happen.
Yeah.
No. Well, let me start from a story that is connected with Stephanos of Alexandria. Perhaps Maria Papathanasiou has already referred to this.
Mm.
The conventional account, as we have it, is that at some point Emperor Heraclius in the 7th century called Stephanus of Alexandria to move from Alexandria, where he was residing, and come to Constantinople, to settle in Constantinople, and to start teaching the quadrivium, the four mathematical sciences. Yeah. So this story, whether it is true or not, it gives us a symbolic passing of the torch between Alexandria and Constantinople. And so this is very important. But again, a historiographical hint, which nowadays it becomes more and more difficult to prove. After Stephanus of Alexandria, we have, according at least to the traditional dating, we have a set of authors like the four alchemical poets, the philosopher Christianos, and the so-called anonymous philosopher. And for the last decade or two, although there were different datings of these authors, we tended to date them as follows. After Stephanus of Alexandria come the four alchemical poets in the 7th century. Why is that? Because some of the topics they're discussing show certain parallels with Stephanus, so they must have been contemporary or nearly contemporary to Stephanus, although Maria Papathanasiou has the idea that the actual author of all four poems was a pupil of Stephanus. Okay. Then we have the philosopher Christianos, who is traditionally dated to the 7th or the 8th century. And then we have the anonymous philosopher, who is traditionally dated to the 8th or the 9th. Well, after the past decade, these things have been reconsidered, I mean, concerning the dating of these authors, a lot, a lot. The main idea right now is that we tend to date them earlier. Yes, and this is very important because some of them might have been earlier or later, but perhaps nearly contemporary with Stephanus. So the whole narrative of Stephanus and the alchemical philosophers after them is starting to shift. And nowadays, 7th century, the 7th century still seems as the hint of Byzantine alchemy. But the 6th century as well has come into focus. So I have talked about the four alchemical poets. Okay, have you ever heard about them? I mean,
I've only heard the name. Tell us more. Tell us okay. What kind of poetry are we talking about? Are we talking about hexameters?
Well, yes, we're talking about iambic poems.
Okay, iambic. Okay, right. Yeah.
There are these four poems which are purportedly written authored by Heliodorus, Theophrastus, Hierotheos, and Archelaus.
Right.
So some of these names might ring a bell, you know, like Heliodorus, because it is, you know, it is certainly or most likely that this is a pseudonym.
Yeah.
Which recalls Heliodorus, the author of the Ethiopica.
Mm.
So we have these four poems, which are allegedly written by four alchemical poets, but we are in the position to know that they are most likely written by one poet. We believe that this is the poet named Heliodorus. Well, I have to say that his name might be maybe a hoax as well.
Right, But
okay,
that guy, one person, the guy who went by the name of Heliodorus.
The person that went by the name Heliodorus is considered to have written all four poems, all four alchemical poems.
Okay.
Well, these alchemical poems deal with chrysopoeia, you know, the making of gold, but each one focuses on different aspects. So, Maria Papathanasiou has very eloquently shown that Heliodorus describes the phases of the so-called living stone. Phreophrastos explains the passion of the Ouroboros dragon, the tail-biting dragon, okay? Which I'm sure you know a lot about, this dragon.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you, do these poems appear in that famous manuscript? Marcianos Graecos,
whatever. Yes.
With the
yes.
Ouroboros.
Yes.
Because that's our earliest graphic Ouroboros in the tradition, I believe.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so right. Yes, we're in
that. But if you're talking about this green and red Ouroboros, which is depicted, you know, its color.
Yeah.
This is in Parisinus Graecos 23-27.
Right, okay.
We have also a depiction of Ouroboros in Marcianos Graecos.
Yeah.
But this famous image of the Byzantine Ouroboros is in Parisinus Graecos 23-27, which was copied in 1478 in Handax, Crete. So, Hierotheos draws specific attention to a rare planetary phenomenon, and Archelaus seems, let's say, to reproduce the mystical atmosphere of Easter, of Pascha, of Easter.
Okay.
But we know from internal aspects of these four poems they must have been authored by a single author that, as you said, went by the name of Heliodorus. Now, as I said, Maria Papathanasiou has claimed that this author, the so-called Heliodorus, was contemporary to Stephanos, and perhaps he was a pupil of Stephanos himself in Constantinople, while he was teaching in Constantinople. And, you know, for some time, things were like, okay, we know that the four alchemical poems flourished in the 7th century, and they more or less had parallels, I mean, concerning their ideas with Stephanos of Alexandria. But then, in 2019, this is very close to us. Mm. In 2019, Mark Loxterman, a Byzantinist and a philologist, drawing on the metrical analysis of the poem, of their verses, and at the same time judging that the parallels between Stephanos and the four alchemical poems are, let's say, inconclusive,
right,
sifted the dating of the poems in the 5th or the early 6th century.
Wow.
So I do not claim that this is definite, but this is something that we have to take into serious consideration and to properly assess. Mm. So I'm telling you all this just to show that the dating, that to date these authors has significant ramification concerning the whole, you know, influx of ideas within the Greek alchemical corpus, because it is most important to show or not to show that this was actually an intellectual father of this, author that followed, and so on and so forth.
Mm, Stephanos.
Stephanos, of course.
I mean, another thing you could say about Stephanos is he is 100% building on a tradition. It's completely clear. So even if we can't trace, even if there were no alchemical writings from Zosimus to Stephanos, you could clearly see that certain of the things that Stephanos is doing go back to Zosimus, right? And then other things you could plausibly say, well, this aspect of alchemy is probably traditional, you know. So it's, I mean, no one's going to say he just made it all up in the 7th century.
No.
The question would be
not at all.
Which bits are original to him, or which which
exactly.
stylistic moves exactly. are his, or which, you know, kind of laboratory ideas are his. Like, what's original to him? That's going to be the difficult thing to say.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. But you know, I don't think that the case is that we don't have, you know, some lesser, let's say, authors between Olympe Odoros and Stephanos of Alexandrias. We do have some authors that we don't usually discuss.
Okay.
Let's say authors like Pelagius, or like the dialogue between Comarius and Cleopatra. But I think that what you just said, the giving of precedence to Stephanos, which is very traditional to historiography itself, to the historiography of Greek alchemy, it is not exactly at stake. But on the other hand, we have to know if there was a nexus of authors and philosophers and thinkers that they were thinking about the same thing. And this is not, you know, a matter of precedence. This is a matter of a cultural environment which led these things to flourish, let's say.
Yeah.
So if we're closer to the 6th century, we're closer to this, you know, great era of Neoplatonism and to figures like Proclus. And we know from another author that I would like to discuss, namely Christianos, that he's very influenced by Proclus.
Mm.
And again, when we have started in the early years of this very decade to seriously study the work of Christianos, certain things were revealed, you know, internal things like his vocabulary, his theological vocabulary.
Right.
His vocabulary is placing him more within the late 6th or the early 7th century than later, as we used to think some decades ago.
Right. And you can date this sort of thing, I guess, because the Christological and theological controversies of the 6th, 7th, 8th centuries are so
exactly.
insanely hardcore and so
so
dateable. Yeah. Like, you know, after the Second Council of Constantinople, it was impossible to say this anymore. Like, that sort
yes,
of thing.
Exactly.
That you can start to get a picture of when people must have written based on what kind of theological terms they used.
Yes, yes, yes.
Got it. Now, that is a beautiful picture of the confused but very populous world of East Roman alchemy, let's say, mm-hmm. at the dawn of the 8th century. We definitely had Stephanos of Alexandria writing. We've got a mm-hmm. host of other writers either to come in the near future or have already written earlier, perhaps. We know there's a tradition between, you know, over these sort of like late antique centuries that maybe we'd like to know more about, but we know it's there. And we can say now that at least part of the action, part of the alchemical activity has moved to Constantinople, right? There's like a colony of alchemy in Constantinople.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it is, you know, symbolical.
Right.
I guess in other parts of the empire, it must have been flourished also, but yes.
Yeah, well, as we'll see, the Arabs are going to pick it up with great gusto.
Of course.
And they obviously picked it up from somewhere, and it's not from Constantinople, so.
Yes, exactly, you know. Exactly.
One of the things I was really interested in when I interviewed Maria Papathanasiou, and I think this will lead to some of your interests in this period, is that we see in Stephanos something that is going to become much more common in the sort of, let's say, Western esoteric tradition going forward, namely an integrated series of occult sciences all functioning as one. So he's an alchemist, but his alchemy is fully astrologized. He mm-hmm. Brings in some sort of Neo-Pythagorean numerical speculation into that. He brings in medicine, of course, and it's all functioning as one sort of sovereign science or occult science. We see moves in that direction in Zosimus, of course, because Zosimus brings in all kinds of weird stuff to his alchemy. It's not simply alchemical laboratory stuff. There's a bit of things that remind us of Hermetica. There's things that remind us of Gnostic texts There's definitely some theological ideas going on, all kinds of stuff. But with Stefanos, it's more systematic, I would say. Is that something that's new with Stefanos? Is he like the first sort of systematic integrated occult scientist in the alchemical world? Or at least the first on record? And going forward, is that a trend that we see carrying on? Because I know one of the things you've talked about is the mathematization of alchemical science, which is very interesting to us. So starting from Stefanos, what can we say about this more kind of integrated approach to alchemy with other sciences?
Yeah. Well, you're right to stay on this. And I think that the consideration of Stefanos as the first author, intellectual, that has integrated in such depth these different traits of wisdom, I think you're right. As you well know, the ties between astrology and alchemy are very old. Mm. Zosimos of Panopolis refers to this. Actually, Zosimos is criticizing those who are over-based, let's say, on astrology.
Right, yeah.
And, of course, this is also the system of thought of Zosimos, whose religion, let's say, is still a matter of debate.
Yeah.
Was he Christian, you know, or not, and all this stuff. But, you know, yes, astrology, medicine, I would add pharmacology, are adjacent to alchemy. We could say that this is only typical because we have also this kind of medicine, which is astrological medicine,
right?
You know, and also draws on astrology in terms of knowing when is the best time to operate a patient, or when your astrological chart you know, coincides with certain movements of the stars and the planets and all these kind of things. On the other hand, astrology in the 7th century, and I do not wish to pass to another topic, astrology to the 7th century, and in particular Christianized astrology, mm-hmm. because astrology has been Christianized by now, as also astronomy was, and medicine, and all these kind of sciences, or some of them, as we tend to call them nowadays, I don't believe in it, pseudosciences.
Yeah.
This is not a term for me, but I'm just referring to it. You know, we have to take into consideration that at the early 7th century, the Byzantine state was in dire straits. And especially after the coming of Emperor Heraclius to power, there was a great war, a Byzantine-Persian war.
Yep.
I mean the Sassanid Persians, of course.
Yep.
And the Persians until then were dominant on the battlefield. They were dominant until the great Byzantine counteroffensive that began in 622. Mm. So there was a widespread fear for the future of the empire. And I don't want to say that this was the sole reason for studying astrology, far from that. But this fear for the future of the empire, in my opinion, and in Paul Magdalenos, mm-hmm. who first stressed it, was crucial in order to examine the design of providence in the celestial movements, and actually of being able to see what the future of the empire would be. And in this sense, we're starting to have an official interest in astrology, and then again, after a little time, in alchemy itself. Mm. And alchemy itself has also to do with, in my opinion, at least, with the great Byzantino-Persian War, Byzantine-Persian War, because at some point the imperial treasury was depleted.
Yeah,
okay. There was nothing.
Yeah.
There was nothing. Okay, and we have, you know, two sources of the era, the Chronicon Paschale, the Paschalion Chronicon, as it is in Greek, which says that Heraclius introduced a new silver coin called the hexagram, and he decreed that imperial payments must be made in that debased coin. This is one clue. The other clue is that in 622, if I'm not mistaken, one of the historians and chronographers of that time, Theophanes the Confessor, said that Heraclius took on loan the money of the great church, and let's say he took also the candelabra and other vessels
Right.
from the great church in order to make a great amount of gold and silver coin. So, in this dire situation, I think that the Byzantine state was in desperate need of money, of resources, and let's say a remedy to this crisis could have been to utilize alchemical knowledge.
Wow.
Yeah, but this is a speculation. I just hope that this is a plausible speculation.
I mean, yeah, why wouldn't it be? It wouldn't be, okay, it definitely wouldn't be the last time that a state
No, of course
turned to
not.
alchemists saying like, okay, we need more gold. We need silver, we need precious metals. Can you do this? And the alchemist said, "But of course, that's my job." And
Yes,
they said, "Great.
exactly.
Okay. What do you need?" And then the funny paradox comes where the alchemist is like, "Well, first, to get started, I need lots of money. To make more gold,
Yes.
you got to give me some gold." And they're like, "Okay, here you
Yes.
go, tons of gold."
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very intriguing speculation. I love it. It's at least important to whatever the situation in the empire whereby alchemy becomes a sort of main part of the arsenal of sciences, right? That the state is at least interested in keeping tabs on.
Yes. Yeah.
Surely the dramatic contraction of the state, not only after the debilitating war with the Sassanians, but then surprise, it's the Arabs, and
Yeah, of
both the
course, of
Sassanians and
course.
the Romans go,
Yeah,
they were this close to being, I mean, Constantinople came within a whisker of being sacked several times.
yeah.
They
Yeah,
lost most of Anatolia, etc. So people will have been incredibly worried. There will have been refugees everywhere you looked, people losing their family farm that they've had in the family for 1,000 years, all manner of stuff going on. People would have been freaking out, essentially, and all manner of ways to figure out what's going on, from folkloric ones like, let's read the Revelation of John and see what the future holds, to much more scientific ones like, let's get serious about astrology and plumbing into the depths of nature and figuring out like the true nature of reality. That's going to give us the answers. All of that will have been very popular in that context.
I agree.
And if you can get some precious metals for your treasury, even better. Okay, so tell me about the mathematization that you see happening in
Oh, yeah.
alchemy in our
Yes.
period.
Before that, with your permission, of course, I would like to go to some aspects of Byzantine alchemy at that time.
Yeah, please, please, please.
I'm talking about the idea of alchemy as Donum Dei, a divine gift, a gift of God, because believe it or not, they are very connected. I mean, with the mathematization of alchemy. First of all, we have to return to Christianos, and we have to say something about his very name. Okay, well, because it is more or less connected with what I'm going to say afterwards. We have this peculiar name. We have this peculiar philosopher, who in the manuscripts is simply called Christianos.
Christian.
Yeah, but we Byzantinists very well know that Christianos, you know, in contrast with what happens, let's say, in Denmark, it was not a very popular name in Byzantium. Actually, it is very rare. It appears only a couple of times.
Okay.
within, you know, the whole Byzantine literature. So this has led me to propose that this is not actually a proper name, but it is an epithet. It means, as you already said, the Christian philosopher. Mm. And this is in itself very important because this epithet seems to emphasize that Christianos is deeply Christian. It tends to emphasize the deeply Christian character of his thought.
Right.
And indeed, Christianos, along with Stephanos of Alexandria, are two of the Byzantine authors that present, that showcase the Christianization of Greek alchemy at such a length. So, Christianos and Stephanos of Alexandria, and this is very important to show that we have this parallel between them, directly quote James 1:17, which says, every good gift and every perfect gift, or something like that, is from above and comes down from the Father of Lights. So the Father of Lights, as you may know, is God, of course, who is considered to be the creator of the luminaries. So this is why he's called Father of Lights. And what Christianos and Stephanos want to show is that we do not have a real inventor of alchemical thought, that all that an alchemist and a chemical philosopher can do is participate in divine knowledge. So we understand alchemy, we grasp the hidden meanings of alchemy by participating in the divine knowledge. You know, the important thing is to show that, and I will try to do this as best as I can, because I'm not a theologian, that in their thought, in the Christian thought, I mean, there is a fundamental difference between creator and creatures, and created things.
Yeah. You know,
this is self-evident. But still, we have to say something about it. The basic difference between creator and creature is the existence by participating in it, or by having it as a quality. And only God has existence as a quality. Only God has existence inherent to his nature. So all creatures, which are created from nothing, of course, they do not participate, they do not access, not participate, they do not access knowledge by nature, but by participation. And, you know, this is a Platonic idea. Methexis, metohi, metechin, so on and so forth, we have this termini technici. But the idea is that in Christian thought, we as creatures, as humans, we have access to knowledge by participation, and we do not have, you know, access to knowledge by nature. This is very important because it simply says that if you wish to delve into alchemical knowledge, in reality, you have to participate in divine knowledge. And the next thing that that comes as a prerequisite is, how does one prepare himself or herself in order to participate into divine knowledge? And the answer that Christianos and the other alchemical authors, including the alchemical poets and Stephanos, is that you have first to live a moral life.
Yeah. So there's that.
Again, this is.
There's an ethical side to this that.
Yeah.
Fundamentally.
And,
right.
Yeah. And when you lead an ethical life, then you shape, let's say, your intellect and your soul into a proper receptacle in order to be visited by divine grace. And then this receptacle, I mean your your soul and your intellect that is ready to receive the divine grace can be enlightened. Why is this important? First, it shows that for the alchemical authors of that period, of that Byzantine period, alchemy is entwined with Christian beliefs. It is very closely intertwined. On the other hand, there is a funny aspect on this. It helps to save the appearances. What I mean by this, if you fail to do something that an ancient authority or that a master of the past says, it is not on him, it is on you, because you do not have a proper contact, and thus you have not been visited by divine grace and be enlightened. So this is on you. The ancient authority never lies.
Right. Yeah. This is this sort of open to failure side of things is maybe the point at which the empiricists of the 17th century and beyond would say, that's why this isn't real science, right?
Because
like, it's got to happen every time. Otherwise, it's not really, you don't really understand what's going on. But in this case, it's like, oh, maybe I had an ethical shortcoming and that's why the stone didn't appear or whatever.
I'm not a good, a moral person, let's say, or something like this.
Yeah.
And this leads to another aspect. Descriptions made by Stephanos, who says that in order to grasp the secrets of alchemy, a philosopher, an alchemical philosopher, has to go to the renunciation of the world, to the mortification of the body, and constantly to pray, to praise God. And one of the alchemical poets, Archelaus, goes so far as to describe the moral life that that an alchemical philosopher should follow in terms of asceticism. But of course, in Western esotericism, as you know much better than me, this is not new. Even in some forms of magic, you have to fast or to prepare your body in order to...
Magic and also initiation. If we're staying in the Greek tradition, it could be
and theurgy,
yeah,
and all these kind of practices.
I wonder if what we're looking at is not just a Christianization of alchemy in name only. Like, if we just call the guy Christianos, the censors at Constantinople won't give us any trouble, right? That would be the caricature idea of a Christianization.
You're right.
But no, like a real Christianization, actually bringing in that particularly Christian ascetic notion of spiritual praxis and preparing the vessel of the human soul for God's presence, notably by doing really bad stuff to the body to make the soul stronger by weakening the body. I mean, this is especially in Syriac Christianity and in a lot of these monasteries, this is where this is really being developed and refined, and they're going hard. There's some very extreme asceticism going on in this period.
Yes, I'm happy that you're saying this, in sharp contrast to what happens in Egyptian monasteries.
Right. So that being said, that could actually represent a genuine and very important evolution of alchemy into something, because first of all, the notion that the alchemical practitioner or the alchemical praxis is at least partly an ethical and interiorized praxis in the soul of the practitioner as much as it is in the Athanor or whatever. This becomes very well known in alchemy going forward, such that even it can go too far and you get the Carl Jungs of the world saying, the lab stuff's not even that important. It's all about the interior thing, you know?
But you know, it is historiographically important to acknowledge this development.
Yeah.
Because it is early.
Yeah.
It is very early.
Yeah, indeed. And maybe we're looking at it right here. I mean, already in Zosimus, you see hints of this.
Of course, that are not there.
In Democritus. Like, Democritus doesn't care about your inner state. Democritus mix the lead with the... Zosimus, you do start to see this idea that, like, the soul is...
You're absolutely right. And he warns Eusebia that she has to follow a moral way of life,
yeah,
you know, in order to follow the proper alchemical tenets and to have an actual outcome.
Yeah.
Because what I would like to say is, you know, this may seem a little pietistic, but it is not. For them, it is part of a methodology. You have to do these things in order to be able to achieve something. And with this proper conduct comes, let's say, a method, a way, which in Christianos is more or less mathematical.
Okay, so what do you mean by that? I like how you segued into this topic of mathematization. Tell us more.